Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on June 27, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on judicial activism. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expression of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we have two experts to help us discuss precisely what is judicial activism, Professor and Dr. John Eastman and Professor Ilya Soman. Each is going to speak to us for about 8 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. Dr. Eastman is the Henry Salvatori Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law, where he also served as the school's dean. He served as a law clerk with Justice Clarence Thomas at the Supreme Court and with Judge Michael Luttig on the Fourth Circuit. Professor Ilya Soman is an associate professor at George Mason University School of Law, where his research focuses on, among other things, constitutional law. He's been a John M. Olin Fellow at Northwestern University Law School and clerk for Judge Jerry Smith on the Fifth Circuit. Their full bios are provided to you on the Federalist Society's website and then the notice you receive for this call. So without further, Professor Eastman, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
And Dean, thanks very much, and thanks also to the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum. I think this one is particularly important because it really goes to the heart of so many questions that we're confronting right now. What is the nature of judicial review? When does it cease being judicial review and cross the line in judicial activism? And it's become commonplace these days in many quarters of the legal academy in particular to accuse the court of judicial activism any time it strikes down a law that the leftward-leaning legal academy doesn't like, or at least to equate those decisions with the judicial activism of the more liberal courts in recent memory that has become such a bad name, as if the two are equal. And I want to try and unpack this this attempt to equate the two kinds of conduct so we see exactly what it is we're talking about. It seems to me that the Constitution quite readily envisions active judicial review. One of the reasons we have an independent judiciary is so that it can invalidate laws that exceed the authority under the Constitution. And there are two kinds of ways in which laws can be unconstitutional. They can be exercises of power beyond the powers delegated to Congress in Article I, or they can violate some of the specific rights or exceptions to that legislative authority, such as exist in Article I, Section 9 or 10, the ban on bills of attainder and ex post facto laws, for example, or the prohibitions that are contained in the Bill of Rights as applicable to the federal government, or in the 14th Amendment as applicable to the states. And both of those express exceptions from the exercise of legislative power are equally parts of the Constitution, and it is the court's duty to strike those down. That's the essence of judicial review. As Alexander Hamilton noted in Federalist 78, the complete independence of the courts of justice to do that particular job is particularly essential in a limited Constitution. Now, Hamilton in 78 was talking only about the limits on legislative power, such as appeared in Article 1, Section 9 and 10, and ultimately then in the Bill of Rights as well. But his colleagues at the Constitutional Convention also recognized the role of the judiciary to keep the exercise of congressional power in check as well when it exceeds their authority. Oliver Ellsworth, for example, contended during the Connecticut Ratifying Convention that the Constitution defines the extent of the powers given to the general government, and if the general legislature, that is Congress, should at any time overleap their limits, the judicial department is a constitutional check. And to hold otherwise would mean that Congress itself gets to define the extent of its power, and as we tend to find out in human history, if you let power police itself, it doesn't do a very good job. That's one of the reasons we have the separation of powers. Now, it seems to me that there's an entirely different thing going on that we properly call judicial activism. And that is not when the court is striking down an act of Congress that exceeds congressional power, or striking down an act of Congress or some executive action that violates provisions of the Bill of Rights, but when the court finds some new right that is nowhere in the Constitution's text, or even anywhere in the political theory that informed that Constitution's text, the natural rights theory that gives us the Ninth Amendment, for example, or what constitutes privileges and immunities of citizenship, but to make up some other right that nowhere existed, and to then use that newfound right that the court has created out of whole cloth and to strike down an act of the Congress or of the state legislatures. That's the very essence of judicial activism. Because in our democratic system of government, our democratic republican form of government, those questions are properly policy judgments that are ultimately left either to the elected representatives of the people or to the people themselves. And for the court to interpose its own views of what some right ought to be, even though not mentioned in the Constitution, is to substitute its judgment for those policy questions for, like I said, the act of the elected officials. That is the essence of judicial activism. And while it may at the margins be hard to distinguish what we mean by liberty in the 14th Amendment or the Fifth Amendment and how far that extends as a constitutionally protected right at the margins to strike down statutes, there are clearly things where the court itself recognizes that it is making up a new right that it was clearly no part of the understanding of the Constitution, and yet nevertheless imposing that newfound right to strike down acts of the legislature. And one of the great recent examples of this comes out of Massachusetts and the state Supreme Court there in the Goodridge versus Massachusetts decision, where even while acknowledging that the Massachusetts Constitution said nothing about same-sex marriage, the court nevertheless created such a right, inferring something into the Constitution that it admitted was not there, and used this newfound right to then strike down the centuries-old marriage laws of the state of Massachusetts. I think that's the quintessential definition of judicial activism. And I'll close with this before I pass it off to Ilya. If we are to get to the point where the unelected judiciary is the final word on those policy judgments, not enforcing provisions of the Constitution, but making up things on their own to use that as a ground for striking down acts of Congress, we will have ceased to that extent to be a democratic form of government, handing over instead the ultimate answer on such policy questions to that unelected tribunal. Lincoln found that very constitutionally troubling in his first inaugural address, and in my view, it remains very constitutionally troubling even to this day. And now over to Ilya.
Professor Soman, go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for organizing this event and John for his very thoughtful remarks, much of which I agree with. I think the concept of judicial activism is one that has become a very popular term on both sides of the political spectrum. It was first widely used by the political right in the 1960s and 70s in criticizing some of the things done by the Warren and Berger Court. But as John mentioned, over the last 10 to 15 years, the idea has been taken up by the political left as part of their efforts to attack the Rehnquist and now the Roberts Court. And in my presentation, I'd like to talk about various different meanings of what judicial activism might be. And I think, unfortunately, it will turn out that most of those meanings are either not very analytically useful or they're not very coherent. So my general bottom line is I think we should talk less about whether a decision is activist or not and more simply about whether it is correct or not. So one possible meaning of activism, one that I think you often see people implicitly use, is the idea, well, a decision is activist if it's wrong, right? So whether it strikes down a law or upholds it, if I think it's wrong, then it's activist. I think, frankly, this is sort of an intellectually lazy use of the term, and it doesn't really add anything to the debate. It just enables people to try to take a lazy shortcut around the much harder task of showing why the decision you don't like is actually wrong. Another meaning that John mentioned is one can define activism as just any time a court strikes down a law enacted by a federal or state legislature. I think this is an analytically coherent definition of the term. It's objective, but it says very little about whether a decision in question actually was right or wrong. A decision striking down a law could be correct or it could be incorrect, and the mere fact that it struck down the law doesn't really tell you very much either way. Now, I would note one caveat on this. There is a small but intellectually serious group of legal scholars who just oppose judicial review in general and think that the meaning of the Constitution should be entirely left up to the political process, people like Mark Tushnet at Harvard, for example. So if you belong to this school of thought, then I think using activism in this way does make sense, because then a decision striking down a law would automatically be wrong pretty much regardless of what kind of law it was. But if you do endorse the general idea of judicial review, then this is not a very helpful definition of the term. Now, another possible definition, I think the one that John seemed to support in his remarks, is that a decision is activist if it departs from the text or the original meaning of the Constitution. I'm very sympathetic to this approach myself. I, to a large extent at least, am an originalist. However, I think if you take that position, what's really doing the intellectual work here is not the concept of activism, but rather the theory of originalism. So if this is your view, then I think it's better to talk about whether a decision is consistent with the text or with the original meaning than to talk about whether it's activist or not. At the very least, it's less confusing given that there are these other definitions of activism which are out there. Now, another possible definition is to say, well, a decision is activist if the judges were guided by their own personal political preferences as opposed to by some sort of objective effort to interpret the law. I think when judges act this way, it is indeed worthy of condemnation. But again, I'm not sure the concept of activism adds anything to this. Moreover, in real life, you rarely, I think, get cases where the judges in their own mind say, well, I'm just ignoring the law for the sake of my policy preferences. In most cases, while they may be unconsciously biased by their preferences, they in their own minds probably think that they're doing their job of enforcing the law. So even in these cases, I think much of the time, it's still better to talk about why the decision in question is wrong, if it is wrong, than to talk about the concept of activism. Finally, I think for many people, concerns about judicial activism may be, in a sense, a stand-in for concerns that judges might be entering into areas where they really don't have expertise or don't have as much expertise as the political branches of government. I think in some cases, this is a legitimate concern, but I think also it's often overblown. One reason I think that John pointed out is that even in situations where the judges have less expertise, it doesn't necessarily follow that they should just defer to Congress or to a state legislature or whatnot, because we don't want either Congress or state governments or any element of government to be the judge of the scope of its own powers. That creates a very dangerous situation and creates some obvious perverse incentives. Moreover, a big part of the whole point of why we have a written constitution is precisely to try to keep the government within constitutional bounds, and that can't be done without at least some significant effort at judicial review. Furthermore, while the judges may not have a lot of expertise on certain issues, when they enforce constraints on the legislature, often it's not ultimately the judges themselves who decide, you know, what will be done in society in this area, but rather what they do is they empower individuals to exercise their freedoms, or they empower state or local governments if what they're doing is striking down congressional laws based on the idea that Congress has exceeded its enumerated powers. So, for instance, if the court says, well, some regulation of speech violates the First Amendment, it's not actually the court that's going to decide what kind of speech will go on. Rather, free individuals will decide it. Similarly, if the court strikes down tomorrow the Obamacare legislation, it will not, of course, be the court which ultimately decides what healthcare policy will be. It will be some combination of individuals deciding what products are purchased in the market and state and local governments deciding. And often, I think individuals individuals and also state and local governments will have greater knowledge about their own needs and interests than either the legislature at the federal level or the courts. So often through judicial review, you may be empowering the more knowledgeable actor, not the less knowledgeable one. Now, that said, I certainly would not suggest that there are never cases where the judiciary should defer because of their lack of expertise, but I'm not sure that the idea of judicial activism is a good way of determining what those cases are. Rather, instead of talking in some general terms about activism, you'd want to ask what the real expertise problems here are, and also consider other relevant considerations, most notably what the Constitution actually says about this. So I think ultimately, while many people like to talk about the concept of judicial activism, I think the amount of heat that is created by such talk generally exceeds the amount of light. So I think we would be better off to talk about things like originalism, the meaning of the text, considerations of expertise, and ultimately whether decisions are right or wrong, rather than whether they're activist or not. So on that note, I conclude, and I really look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Before we go to the audience questions, Professor Eastman, do you want to take a minute or two to respond?
Yeah. I want to thank you, Leah, for a very helpful analytical framework in which to discuss this, and putting the different kinds of interpretive meanings on what we might mean by judicial activism, I think helps add a great deal of clarity to what has been deliberately a confused conversation to try and create a kind of moral relativism between the two different kinds of conduct. Judicial review and judicial activism that we've been talking about. I do want to add an additional piece of this. Many, like Mark Tushnet, as he said, thinks that the whole concept of judicial review is foreign to the Constitution. And I would refer people to the debates in the Constitutional Convention, particularly over whether the courts would have a power of revision or whether there would be a council of revision comprised of Supreme Court justices to basically have an added veto power over acts of Congress. And you cannot look at that debate without coming away from the conclusive view that everybody at the Constitutional Convention assumed that the court would have the ability, the power of judicial review, to declare an unconstitutional law void. The entire issue over the Council of Revision in the Constitutional Convention was whether the justices would also have the power to veto or negate laws on policy grounds. And the fact that the Constitutional Convention debated that and ultimately rejected that role for the courts, I think is something that we have to keep in mind. And yet all too frequently we find courts substituting their policy judgments, sometimes under the guise that they're trying to just follow the Constitution, but in their more honest moments when they admit that the Constitution had nothing to say about the subject, and they're never they're going to less create a rule that's more to their liking. I think it's fair to say that that is the essence of this inappropriate judicial role, whether we call it judicial activism or something else. It's the court exercising will, not judgment, exercising those powers of a council of revision that the Constitutional Convention expressly declined to give to the courts, that I think is at stake.
Professor Soman, a minute or two?
I agree mostly with what John just said. I would add only that in addition to what John said about the Constitutional Convention, it's worth pointing out that in the Federalist Papers, James Madison said that it would be the Supreme Court that would decide disputes over the scope of federal power when they arose between the state governments and the federal government. So I think that clearly envisions judicial review with respect to the issue of whether the Congress had exceeded the scope of its power or not, exactly the sort of thing that the court has considered in cases like Lopez and Raich and now obviously the individual mandate case. So I think it is pretty clear that at the founding, the power of judicial review was envisioned. And so therefore, I think people like Tushnet, while they have a serious argument, I think that argument is not going to be an originalist argument. It's going to be based on other sorts of considerations, or would have to be, I think.
Okay. We're now going to open the floor to questions from the audience. Let's go to the first question.
Hello. This is James Lucas from timelyrenewed.com. I would like the professor's view on this approach, which is to say in the end, the judicial branch, the argument is circular, because all of these arguments about what is or isn't judicial activism, which from my point of view has now become a word like a term like cult or slut, you know, it really doesn't mean anything anymore except that you don't like what you're applying it to, is that they're circular. In the end, it's just, you know, the judges themselves are just kind of spinning in a circle and deciding on what these, you know, what the appropriate level of judicial activity is. It's not the solution really political. Under the original scheme of the Constitution, large constitutional issues were to be settled not by judicial review, but by the amendment process. And so I would like their views on the argument that what we really need to do is, instead of having this circular argument amongst the judges about what judges should do, we really should be looking rather to doing something to reform the amendment process so that it can become active again, so that these large ultimate issues can be settled in the way that they were intended to be settled, which is through the political process. And also that would sort of put an outer bound on judicial activism by giving, you know, a check on the Supreme Court's ability to change the meaning of the Constitution, and a popular check, which would be very powerful and consonant and consistent with the whole scheme of checks and balances and the ultimate fact that the legitimacy of the Constitution is based on popular sovereignty.
This is John Eastman. That's a very good question, and let me add a different check that I think the founders envisioned as well, and that is a more vibrant impeachment power over against the courts for conduct, willful failure to adhere to the Constitution in their rulings from the bench. And I'm not talking here about the realm of legitimate, reasonable, people can disagree, disputes about what particular clauses of the Constitution mean. I'm talking about willful recognition that the Constitution says X, and I'm going to do Y anyway. And a great example of this was a series of questions that was asked by one federal judge currently sitting on the bench, Harry Pragerson, during his confirmation hearings in the late 1970s. And he was asked point blank, if the Constitution was clear and it disagreed with his personal views of what the law ought to be, which way would he rule, to uphold the Constitution or to push his personal views? And he said he would push his personal views. The questioner came back and said, maybe my question wasn't clear. I said, if the Constitution is clear on this, and the judge said, yes, I heard your question. I would adhere my personal views. Now, it seems to me that's the very essence of judicial activism. And the fact that at the front end he was committing to ignoring his constitutional role should have been disqualifying in the confirmation process. But as he started making good on that promise that he made under oath in that confirmation hearing, in my view, the founders envisioned a more vigorous impeachment check to thwart just that kind of conduct. The problem with the amendment process, and I agree it could be streamlined so that it can be more frequently used to counteract judicial decisions of this magnitude. The problem with that is we find that the same court that has just been corrected will be the one sitting in judgment on how to interpret the new clause as well. And I'll give you here an example that comes out of California in our state constitution. We had a provision making it unconstitutional to give gifts of private funds of taxpayer funds to private entities or private individuals. The courts then held that that didn't apply to pensions that were given after the fact, after the work was done. And so the people of California adopted a constitutional amendment saying that the legislature can't authorize retroactive increases in compensation. And the courts immediately said, well, that only means the legislature can't authorize it. It doesn't mean that all the local government agencies can't authorize it. And so a few years later, the people said, no, we really mean it amendment. They said neither the legislature of the state nor any other agency can do this. And here we are 40 years later still dealing with the courts upholding retroactive increases in the pensions in this state. So it seems to me that you have to have a more direct check on the judiciary itself if it's going to be so willful in violating the provisions of the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what John said. I would add a couple of points. One is the U.S. has one of the most difficult to amend constitutions in the world, so it's extremely difficult to use that mechanism. One could argue for, in effect, a constitutional amendment to make amendment easier, but obviously that itself would be difficult to enact. On the other hand, there are various other checks on the judiciary, such as the appointments and confirmation process. In practice, it's difficult for judiciary to get too far beyond what the other branches of government or the general public will tolerate, given the way by which they're appointed, and given also that at least to some extent they rely on the other branches of government to enforce their decisions. So it is actually not the case that the judges can simply do whatever they want. Maybe as a kind of matter of constitutional theory or legal doctrine they can, but as a matter of actual practice, there are significant constraints. Ultimately, I think I would favor a system under which the Constitution would be somewhat easier to amend than it is now. Still, I would make it difficult. I wouldn't say you can do it just by a simple political majority, but I would make it a little bit easier than now, because I do think that overall it's probably better to make sort of necessary adjustments to the Constitution through the amendment process than through creative judicial interpretation.
And let me add that one of the fixes you would want to do is it got less to do with the majorities that are necessary to get through a constitutional amendment, but the mechanism. If we're talking about an expansive claim of federal power that is being violated and that the courts are sanctioning, then it's obviously not likely to come out of Congress itself an amendment that would limit its own power. And so facilitating a more direct course from the state constitutional, from state legislatures or constitutional calls from the states directly that could be limited to a particular issue, I think would go a long way toward getting around the bottleneck that the powers in Washington seem to put up.
Let's take another question.
Good afternoon. This is Gerard Lehman from the Boston chapter. I'll probably reveal my lack of legal education with this question, but here it goes. Why does our system of judicial review not include sort of an official process to essentially remand to Congress any law or portion of a law that a court might find problematic? And was that ever considered in the founding era?
Thanks. You know, that's a good question. I don't think I'm not aware of any consideration of such a mechanism. But in one scenario, it's probably unnecessary. Congress doesn't need an official order from the court to remand to look. What you did here was unconstitutional. Fix it. Congress can read the court's opinion, striking down their act, and fix it unilaterally without such an order. So that may help explain why no such remand mechanism was formally included.
Professor Soman, do you want to weigh in here?
No, I don't really have much to add to what John said.
Okay, looks like we have one more question on our board. Then our phone lines are open. Go to the next question.
Yeah, two things, Bob Davis in Maine. Judge Bork would argue, I think, that it's activism to find privacy in the Constitution and then launch into the abortion issue from that. But why would the Ninth Amendment, because it would seem to me that liberty necessitates a certain amount of privacy, why would the Ninth Amendment not cover liberties such as privacy as part of the limitation upon the power of the federal government, at least? And the other question is, I think that there is a pretty easy political control over the court, which is just not used for some reason, and that's by Congress controlling the appellate jurisdiction and or standing of the court.
Yeah, very good questions, both of them. Let me take up the first, because I think you've gone right at the heart of the one issue we haven't discussed yet. And that is, what do you do with unenumerated rights? Judge Bork's position, largely tracked by Justice Scalia on the court itself, is that the court's job is to only give effect to explicitly enumerated rights. And when you take the more amorphous clauses, liberty and due process, privileges and immunities, to read into those clauses more than the history and traditions support is to cross the line from judicial review to judicial activism. There's a deeper understanding, and that is there are unenumerated rights which the natural law tradition of our founding recognized without specifically enumerating. And we, you know, you look at cases like Myers and Pierce versus Society of Sisters that recognize the fundamental right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children. That's nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, and yet it seems inherent in the notion of liberty, properly assessed against that common natural rights tradition. It's when we depart from that and become entirely unmoored from that tradition that this search for unenumerated rights becomes a freewheeling power given to the courts to strike down policy judgments with they disagree. And Judge Bork and Justice Scalia, to avoid that freewheeling nature, or what I call the Brennan problem, have just said, we're going to stick with the text, thank you, ma'am, nothing else. But of course, I think that does short shrift to the founders' understanding of some of the very important clauses, like Republican guarantee or privileges and immunities, or this grand concept of due process of law that had to be given some meaning from that tradition. And it's in that interplay where we see the three positions: stick with the text, do whatever you want, the Brennan position, or the middle position, that is, look at it in light of that history and traditions, but only limited to that history and traditions. Otherwise, you're handing off power to the courts. And for folks that want to look at this in greater detail, there's been a great deal of scholarship on those questions, and I think they are really critical. A lot of it is summarized in an article I had in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy a few years ago, volume 28, called Judicial Review of Unenumerated Rights. Does the Warren Court problem still matter, or does Marbury versus Madison still survive in a post-Warren Court world? And you can look at that article and also the other scholarship cited in that article for a really broad understanding of the problem here and how to distinguish, given that problem, between proper judicial review and improper judicial activism.
Professor Solomon.
So I think that Judge Bork was probably wrong to state, well, something like the Ninth Amendment is just an ink blot and we should just ignore it. And more generally, people like Bork and others think are incorrect to say that we should not enforce unenumerated rights. I think the problem is this. When the Constitution has a broad general statement, like in the Due Process Clause or in the Ninth Amendment, to say that you're not going to enforce it is, in fact, ignoring the text and the original meaning of the Constitution. So to say that you're not going to enforce this broad wording is, I think, to ignore the text and the original meaning, just to say, well, the framers and people didn't have the right or the power to use broadly worded phrases as opposed to narrowly worded ones. And as various scholars such as Randy Burnett and others have shown, there is actually a lot of evidence on what the Ninth Amendment meant and what kinds of liberties it's supposed to protect. The evidence isn't perfect, but it's not perfect for many aspects of the Constitution. Now, in terms of jurisdiction stripping statutes, I think the second part of your question, I think Congress does have that power, and in recent decades it hasn't exercised it much, but I think the threat of it is out there, and the mere possibility of it does probably have some influence on judicial behavior. I do think there might be some outer bounds to how far Congress can go in that direction, in that it may not be constitutionally permissible for Congress to simply say that there are categories of constitutional rights that no court can review no matter what, but they can certainly, if they want, change around which courts have the power to review which issues.
All right, let's go to the next question.
The way substantive due process is taught in law school is that the limitation on freewheeling would be based on sort of genuflecting to history and tradition. And in relation to the Goodrich process, the way the court arrived at their decision, if you could comment on that, because if you read it, at least my reading is that while they enumerate this right in substantive due process, they do nothing in the way of looking at history and traditions to create this right, which other substantive due process rights have been created. Could you just comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And Judge Vaughn Walker in the Northern District of California in the Proposition 8 litigation does exactly the same thing. In fact, he explicitly acknowledges in his opinion that this this newfound right he's created was no part of the history and traditions, but he finds those history and traditions wanting, and so he creates the right and then uses that to strike down the initiative adopted by over 7 million voters in California. And that's what I'm talking about is judicial activism. And it's not because I disagree with the conclusion or the policy judgment. I disagree with the fact that the courts, without some rooting in either text or history and tradition, are nevertheless substituting their policy judgments for the elected representatives, or in that case, the direct will of the people. And I think if we're going to have an understanding of judicial activism that is improper, that allows us to distinguish it from judicial review, which is the proper role of the courts, and a particularly important role of the courts in a democratic system of government that also is designed to check majorities from infringing on individual rights, you have to have an independent judiciary that can engage in judicial review. But it seems to me that making this stuff up, not tying it, not mooring it to anything, is the essence of where you've crossed the line into improper conduct by the judiciary.
Here, I think we're going to disagree a little bit, because I think actually there was a defensible basis for the Goodridge ruling, namely that, as one of the justices pointed out in his concurring opinion, Massachusetts is one of a number of states that has a state equal rights amendment, which forbids virtually all government discrimination on the basis of sex. And I think a law which says that a man may marry a woman, but another woman may not, even if the sole difference between the two is gender, I think that is precisely the kind of law that violates the State Equal Rights Amendment, and therefore I think there was a basis for that. Now, this is a different line of reasoning than was pursued by the other three judges in the 4-3 Goodridge majority. I think their reasoning, I think it was, in part for reasons that John mentioned, I think much less persuasive, but I think viewing this as a situation where people's rights differ solely on the basis of gender, if a man cannot marry another man under this kind of law, whereas a woman can, and that discrimination holds even if there are no other differences between the two people besides their gender, I think that does violate the Equal Rights Amendment, and I think the text of that amendment, as adopted by Massachusetts and a number of those other states, I think is very clear.
Yeah, I'm glad we're getting some areas of disagreement here, because I disagree with that. So, you know, one of the things both in Massachusetts equal rights analysis and in federal constitutional equal protection analysis that you have to ascertain before making the judgment that the equal protection has been denied is, are the people similarly situated? So the issue in both contexts, both in the state law question that Goodridge faced and in the federal constitutional questions that both the DOMA cases and the Proposition 8 litigation are facing, is, are same-sex and opposite-sex couples similarly situated with the institution of marriage? And that turns out to be a fundamental policy question, much less a question about whether people are being given or denied equal rights. And if the policy judgment is marriage matters as an institution that was designed to foster the relationship where procreation by the two people that give birth to the child and then rear that child, if that judgment is an important policy question, to take that away by some expansive use of equal protection that ducks the critical issue on whether these relationships are similarly situated for that purpose, is, I think, to substitute the court's will on that policy question, not to enforce a constitutional guarantee of equal protection. And that's what I'm talking about when you take judicial activism and you manipulate amorphous clauses in the Constitution to reach some end that was clearly no part of either the text when written, the intent when understood and ratified, or the history and traditions that informed it. You are now operating in an unmoored fashion to do what you think is the better policy judgment than the people of the state have themselves chosen. And that's when I think the line gets crossed.
So just very quickly, I think there are many reasons on policy grounds why one might want to justify various forms of sex discrimination, but that's precisely the kind of policy judgment that an Equal Rights Amendment is supposed to forbid. That is, it's supposed to take off the table arguments which say, well, men and women are different in certain ways, and therefore the government can engage in sex discrimination in these areas. So moreover, I think child raising is a particularly weak basis for making this judgment, given that Obviously, under Massachusetts law and under every state's law, lots of heterosexual couples are allowed to get married, even if there's lots of evidence showing that they would not be very good at child raising, or even if they have no intention or no biological ability or whatnot to raise children in the first place.
All right. So as not to shift into a full discussion of the marriage fights, let's get to another question.
Okay. Here we go. Looks like we have four more questions left at this point, so plenty to get to.
Gerard Lehman from Boston again. I just want to get the panelists' views on sort of that popular belief that at least existed 5 or so years back that Congress was essentially punting any tough questions over to the court, leaving what they probably suspected to be problematic language in laws, certainly vagueness in laws, in setting up the court system to fail, essentially. I'd love to get your views. When we hosted Justice Scalia 5 or 6 years ago, there was a lot of discussion in the crowd about that, but I don't think any of us actually asked him his thoughts on that. I'd love to get yours. I seem to be consuming less media these days that make that accusation. So I'll take my answer offline. Thanks.
Thanks very much. I think that's a terrific question, and I actually think it's one of the negative consequences of a judicial review on steroids, that the Supreme Court is not just one of the interpreters of the Constitution, nor even the final interpreter of the Constitution, but in many ways the only interpreter of the Constitution. And that's a route that has gradually been taking root over the last 50 years or so. And you see it play out in acts of Congress all the time. So I remember over the debate over the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, the McCain-Feingold statute that was struck down ultimately in Citizens United, there were a number of statements on the floor of Congress, both by proponents and opponents of the bill, that challenged the constitutionality. And at the end of the day, they just punted. The president, too, thought that there were major provisions of the bill that were unconstitutional, and yet he nevertheless signed it. And I think that was a dereliction of duty by both the Congress and the president. Their obligation is to not pass on statutes or sign them that they think are unconstitutional as well. And the notion that they could just defer all of those questions to the court to sort out, even though they were greatly suspicious of the constitutionality, is greatly problematic, particularly when looked at in light of a series of doctrines that the court has developed to give a presumption of constitutionality to acts of Congress on the theory that it's a co-equal branch that deliberately considered the constitutionality and, in their view, thought it was constitutional. All of these deferences to those constitutional determinations by Congress that, in point of fact, are increasingly never made or made over the explicit concern that there is unconstitutional conduct being codified into the law. That you end up with this weird system where the court is sanctioning unconstitutional conduct by the federal branches, deliberately not performing its role that the founders envisioned.
So I think I largely agree with that. I do think that while there definitely is a danger that sometimes happens that Congress will simply punt to the courts, I think there is also an opposite danger, which is that if Congress knows that the courts will simply defer to its judgment, as much of the time it does in the area of federalism and enumerated powers, that will lead Congress to take its constitutional duty less seriously, precisely because they know that when it comes before the courts will just defer to whatever Congress did. And I think, you know, as bad as the campaign finance debate was in Congress, at least they did take the issue seriously, and there were many senators and representatives that raised it, whereas in the area of federalism, like, for instance, when the Obama health care law was being considered by Congress, many of the members actually just showed utter contempt for the whole concept that there might be constitutional limits on their power to do this. And I think one reason why they took that attitude is because they had seen that sort of federalism was an area that most of the time the courts themselves also didn't take very seriously, so they felt that they could just do whatever they wanted. I think if Congress knows that the courts will take these issues seriously and not simply defer to Congress's definition of its own powers, then that will give Congress at least some incentive to take its job more seriously as well, if only because they will want to make sure that the legislation they pass is not going to be struck down, right? If only because they have that sort of self-interested incentive.
Let's go to the next question.
Hi, my name is Theodore Gebhardt. I think the question I had has just been addressed. I was going to ask whether or not statutes should enjoy the presumption of constitutionality, and if they are otherwise ambiguous, should the court kind of bend over backwards to interpret them in a way that is consistent with the Constitution. But I think you've just addressed that.
Well, and let me just add this. I think, you know, one of the more significant questions that was asked by Justice Kennedy during the oral argument on the individual mandate in the Health Care Act was just that. Given the novelty and the process by which this bill, you know, kind of went through Congress, should we give it the normal presumption of constitutionality that we've been giving to congressional statutes? I think that was a hugely significant question. And as Congress is more and more demonstrating that it's not taking those constitutional obligations seriously, I think the court should cease giving a presumption of constitutionality to the statutes.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think ultimately there shouldn't be a presumption of either constitutionality or unconstitutionality. What the court should do is look at the particular law and see if it's constitutional or not. But I think, as John says, there particularly should not be such a presumption in areas of law where it's clear that Congress has not been taking its constitutional responsibilities seriously. And by the way, this does not apply only to the Democrats with respect to the individual health care mandate. It applies to, unfortunately, to the performance of congressional Republicans on many constitutional issues as well. So I think over the last few decades, especially on federalism issues, sort of a political culture has emerged in Congress where they don't really take these issues seriously. I think maybe over time that can be changed, but we're not going to succeed in changing it unless the courts hold Congress's feet to the fire more than they have been doing.
Can I ask a quick follow-up to that?
Sure.
What happens if, what would your view be if the language is sufficiently ambiguous, but a court could infer meaning into the language of the statute in a way to find the statute constitutional? Should the court do that?
Yeah, I'm less troubled by that practice. It's easy to find ambiguity in almost anything. And if one reading of a statute renders it unconstitutional and another would render it constitutional, for the court to choose a constitutional reading seems an appropriate way to deal with just the normal ambiguity of language. So I'm less troubled by that. Where I am troubled is when Congress seems pretty clear that they want to accomplish something and even push the limits on what their constitutional authority is. And you see this, for example, in some of the partial birth abortion legislation and other restrictions. And the court will then deliberately interpret away what Congress quite evidently was trying to do under this theory that will avoid the constitutional question. That doesn't say that the other interpretation would have been unconstitutional, but the court narrows the statute's reach in order to avoid that question. And I think that may run counter to what Congress was trying to do, which is to legislate right up to the limits of its constitutional authority. And so, you know, there's one aspect of that question where I'm not troubled by, but it can be misused in the way that I think it has on occasion to really undermine what Congress was trying to do.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I think that if you really have two completely equally good interpretations of a statute, it may make sense to construe it to avoid the constitutional problem in that case. But I think actually it won't often be the case that two interpretations are equally plausible. And where that's not true, then I think you should interpret the law correctly. And if it's unconstitutional, you strike it down rather than interpreting it incorrectly to avoid having to do sort of additional work of determining whether it's unconstitutional.
Let me ask you, sticking with the presumption of constitutionality, does it differ in strength for a federal statute versus a state statute? And if so, what accounts for that difference?
I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm not calling to mind exactly, but my suspicion is that, yes, it does differ. And that's in part designed because in our federal system, Congress is a co-equal branch at the federal level with the court. whereas the states on question of federal constitutional law are clearly subsidiary. And so that would lend itself to a greater deference to acts of Congress and to the state legislatures. And I seem to recall some case law on that point, but not off the top of my head with any specifics.
I think there is case law. I can't remember either the exact sites, but I'm not sure that case law is right on this question. The Constitution doesn't say anything about giving greater deference to Congress versus state governments. I think, if anything, it's more dangerous to allow an unconstitutional federal law to stand than an unconstitutional state law, because an unconstitutional federal law affects the entire nation, whereas an unconstitutional state law affects just that one state. So in my view, the right approach is to treat them equally, although I recognize that's certainly not the dominant view.
Good. Looks like we have a couple more questions. We've got a little more than 5 minutes, so let's carry on.
Honorable unconstitution.org. Let's examine further the problem of protecting the unenumerated right in cases between a citizen and his state. I've done an analysis to try to bring out as many as possible of the unenumerated rights and found them generally to fall into two categories. One, a right, variations on a right to a presumption of non-authority, similar to Randy Barnett's presumption of liberty, and a right to the means to supervise one's officials. If you combine that with old common law rule of that powers are strictly interpreted, then you have a large body of federal rights that exist simply because there are no powers granted to federal agents to infringe upon them. But states may delegate such powers, and then the question arises, where does one find the limiting principle to separate rights that are not properly exercised by delegations of state power and those that are? So perhaps we could explore those boundaries a little bit.
John, that's a very good question, and probably is going to require a greater response than even another full hour of a teleforum would allow us to do. Let me try and frame the question a little bit this way. One of the concerns Madison and others at the founding had with even having a Bill of Rights is it would flip the presumption that the original presumption of the Constitution is that the federal government, could exercise only those powers granted, and that therefore you didn't need to have a Bill of Rights like you needed to have with the king, because the government itself did not have unlimited powers out of which you had to carve certain preserves for protection of individual rights. By enumerating certain rights, they were concerned that the interpretive force of that would then mistakenly read into the delegated powers an unlimited delegation of power. And it was the Ninth Amendment and in part the Tenth Amendment that was designed to counteract that presumption. But you're also right to point out that similar issue doesn't exist or doesn't necessarily exist in the state governments, where there is a broader delegation of sovereign powers to the state governments, the so-called police power, the power to advance the health and safety and welfare and morals of the people, was a broader delegation of power. And then in that sense, you do need a more vigorous carve-out of rights, which all of the original state constitutions had for just that reason. Now, when you get beyond those that are expressly written, and what about these unenumerated rights that all of the founders seem to recognize exist? And they're part and parcel of the theory of the Declaration of Independence. You know, you don't find the right to pursuit of happiness listed in any of the Bill of Rights. Well, you do in a couple, but in most of the Bill of Rights in the states, and certainly not in the federal Constitution. And yet it's there as one of the inalienable rights we have, not from government, but from the Creator. Until you can understand the nature of the self-evident truth of that claim, the courts are not going to be able to adequately define and then defend those rights. And we've lost that language, that philosophical foundation in the last century, and until we recover it to some great extent, we're not going to be able to, with any precision, answer those questions that are really of much longer standing philosophical basis.
Professor Selman.
I tend to agree. I would add, obviously, that this raises such profound issues we could devote an entire teleform of its own to it. I would note one additional difference between the states and the federal government, and that is that if the federal government violates some constitutional right or abuses its powers, it does affect the entire nation, whereas if a state government does it, it affects just that state, and people even have the option potentially of voting with their feet for another state. So I think it makes sense to have a constitutional scheme that constrains the federal government somewhat more than the states are constrained. That said, obviously, there are various complex interpretive questions, some of which were raised by the founders. I do think, actually, that the founders tried to deal with this issue of that if you have a Bill of Rights, that might imply that the federal government has powers to do all sorts of other things that it otherwise might not. And that, I think, is part of the purpose of the Ninth Amendment, where they say that the enumeration of certain rights shouldn't disparage others that are retained by the people. I think that was the founders' attempt, maybe not completely successful, to solve that particular problem.
We've got less than a minute left, but I want to try and get this final question in if we can.
Hi, Howard Katz from Elon University School of Law. You may have already touched on this, and it may be a topic for the future. The passing comment about Scalia suggesting that sometimes we might want to look behind the legislative process. Since this is the season of looking for limiting principles, I'm curious whether either panelist has any idea, any thoughts about whether that is something that should be opened up in the future, or is that something that has within its own nature a limiting principle? Is the court going to start looking at the failure of Congress to look at constitutionality, which, as long as I can remember until very recently, is something Congress has done? They have not seriously considered constitutionality.
Well, in the early days, they considered it extensively. You look at the debates in the 1790s, for example, that Congress, you know, on spending bills, on the Jay Treaty, on all of these, I mean, major constitutional questions were hotly contested and debated on the floor of Congress. And they only would act and further the legislation on if they became convinced that they had the constitutional authority to do so. I agree in recent years, partly as a phenomenon of the New Deal, where this notion took root that they could do whatever they wanted. And there was a brief attempt in the 1990s to reimpose some constitutional inquiry on Congress, and that they now have to file for every bill a statement of what the constitutional authority is. And that rule has become laughable. If it dealt with a regulation, they cited the Commerce Clause. If there was money attached, they cited the Spending Clause, and that's all they needed to do. And the notion that either of those clauses imposes any limits on them was long dead and buried until 1995, and the revival of that original view that these powers are limited comes out of the court in Lopez. So I do think we have a conversation going on about the limits, and I think the new crowd in Congress is more attuned to that view that there are limits, that I think we're going to see a revival of those kind of conversations with greater seriousness than we've seen in a while.
So I don't think that the court should look behind the legislative process in the sense of saying, well, we'll only uphold the law if we think that Congress has done a good job debating the constitutional issues or has taken them seriously. I think Congress can and sometimes does pass perfectly constitutional laws without paying much attention to whether they're constitutional or not. But I do think that this does go to the question of judicial deference. if the judiciary is going to defer to Congress's judgment on constitutionality as opposed to simply, you know, taking the laws as they come and checking whether they're constitutional or not, then at the very least, I think that kind of deference is not appropriate unless there's at least some evidence that Congress is taking its constitutional responsibilities seriously. Now, if it's not, that doesn't mean the law should be struck down. It may be perfectly constitutional. It just means that the court needs to make its own independent judgment about whether the law fits within Congress's powers or not.
We will let that be the final word, and let me thank both our experts today, Professors Ilya Soman and John Eastman, for joining us. Thanks also, as always, to our audience for calling in and engaging. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.